This is New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking with Glenn Feldman, who is the author of The Irony of the Solid South, Democrats, Republicans, and Race, 1865 to 1944. I hope that you enjoy this interview with Glenn. Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and today, as I mentioned, I have Glenn Feldman to talk about his book, The Irony of the Solid South, Democrats, Republicans, and Race, 1865 to 1944. Glenn, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Heath. Doing great.
Glenn, yeah, this is a great book. Before we get to it, if you could just tell us all a little bit about yourself, where you are now, where you've been, where this book fits into your larger research pursuits. So, who are you?
Well, I'm born and raised in Birmingham, Alabama. Kind of a diverse background, not your typical Southern Deep South background. My father's a Brooklyn Jew, so we have that kind of diverse influence. My mom is from South America, from Lima, traces her roots to the north of Spain. But I've grown up in the South, and I've lived in Birmingham the majority of my life with a couple of brief stints elsewhere, New York for a while, Tennessee for a while, Nashville for a while, but basically in the Deep South. And the book has grown out of my interest with politics, American, Southern, otherwise, and issues of power, who holds power and why they hold power and what they do with that power over time.
So, Glenn, you've written a provocative book here. In preparing to write this book, did you intend to provoke?
Well, let me give you an answer of yes and no. And I give you that answer with the full realization that it's a terrible answer. And with the stipulation that when I receive that answer from other people, I usually despise the answer. But in this case, it happens to fit. Let me start out with no. First, no, I didn't intentionally set out to write a provocative book. I intended to engage in a search for the truth, as impossible as that sounds, and see where the facts and the evidence led me, with the realization that in a humanistic inquiry, I could never really arrive at the truth, the complete, absolute, unmitigated, perfect truth, but that I was going to try to get as closely as I could to it. So that was the main goal. Now, the yes part is, yes, I do realize that the book is provocative. The result of the inquiry is provocative and will be quite provocative in the hands of some people. But I hope that it's provocative in the best sense of that word, in provoking or stimulating people to think about, rethink their own assumptions, biases, prejudices, and so forth. Actually, I found the evidence to be so overwhelming that there was really no need for me to, you know, embellish or go beyond what's in the record. So, I hope that answers the question.
And the deep and well-sourced research, I think, is a testament to the background you give and the argument you really develop as a researcher, not as simply a stone thrower. And so it's a book that should be read by a lot of people, and not everyone is going to agree with your conclusions. But you build such an interesting argument. Let's start early in the book, and one of the concepts that I think sets up your perspective and what you're trying to do is, so early in the book you refer to, quote, the Reconstruction Syndrome. I wonder if you can define and explain a little bit what that syndrome is and how it relates to the book that you wrote.
Right. The the Reconstruction Syndrome is kind of a concept or idea I came up with a long time ago, really. I guess it appears in my work maybe a dozen years ago. And what I noticed about the South is that many of the things that occur today have occurred yesterday. and the day before and the year before and the century before. And so I began to look at Reconstruction as a experience that the South had that the rest of the country did not have. Of course, that's not a new idea. C. Van Woodward probably did the most important and provocative work on that subject. But the Reconstruction syndrome that I came up with, the South today still carries the weight of that trauma. It's the only section of the country that has been defeated militarily and occupied militarily by a foreign force. There were only 22,000 troops, federal troops, in 11 southern states, and that's not a lot. But the psychological trauma left the South with some enduring emotional and psychological baggage. First of all, a very anti-black, racist dedication to white supremacy, which has haunted the South for a long time. Secondly, very anti-federal view on things, anti-federal government, an aversion to taxation, an aversion to funding public education as something that would be subversive, possibly, especially when it came to race and the lower economic classes of whites, an aversion to outsiders, which pops up again, of course, with the modern civil rights movement, an aversion to a suspicion, a hostility to anything related to the central or federal government. And so the South, I think, has been burdened by that syndrome. It tends to pop up, I believe, in times of acute stress. So it's a concept that I use throughout the book and throughout my work.
Yeah, and one of the first reactions, I'm sure, those hearing about your description of this political community would be that, but what about that example? What about this person who doesn't fit what you described? And you deal with that in the book. You have an extended discussion of the nature of scientific and historical inquiry. So you write, and I quote, "Nuance is not a bad thing in and of itself. In fact, the search for nuance is praiseworthy. But that there are some risks to anecdotes, and not in quotes. So I wonder, what is the scholarly dilemma that you are concerned about, and why is it so important and so prominent in the subject matter you study to deal with this question of anecdote and generalization and trying to make sense of this world from the perspective of a historian and of a social scientist?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and that question is there throughout the book. It's in the background, et cetera. And I think you hit it on the head. When a book is written, any book is written that deals with ideas and so forth, at the bottom of it, there's an attempt to search for the truth. What really is the truth? What happened? What does it mean? That sort of thing. I recognize as an historian that the subject matter that I deal with, human beings, the past, human nature is not the same subject matter as someone dealing with physics or biology or chemistry deals with. Rocks, you know, don't have mortgages. Plants don't have children they need to send to college. So I'm dealing with human beings, and that makes things very different. Number one, I have to recognize that my own biases, my own prejudices affect my choice of subject matter. They affect how I interpret data or information. But more than that, if you look at history becomes relatively useless, I think, if it becomes, you know, excuse the phrase, one damn thing after the other. If I just document one thing after the other with no context or no attempt to generalize, then it's of limited value. The problem is, what about the exceptions? What about the rebels, what about the dissenters, what about the nonconformists who do not fit into the stereotype, or even beyond the stereotype, don't fit into the traditional or dominant narrative? What about them? What about their efforts? Weren't they noble? Weren't they praiseworthy? Weren't they worth something? And the answer is yes, they were. But did they define the general pattern of what happened? And the answer, that is the critical question. And I think that historians, too often we get hung up on documenting the exceptional, and in many respects we are talking about the exception that proves the rule, especially when it comes to race, when it comes to politics, when it comes to the Southern past, when it comes to issues of whether or not the South is truly distinctive or exceptional as opposed to the rest of the nation.
One of the things, and you cover a long time period, again, 1865 to 1944, and we don't have enough time to talk about all of the details that you work through in the book. One of the things that I was particularly interested in was the shift that you trace from the agitation directed primarily against African Americans to others, and that is Catholics, Irish, Italians, and Jews. And I wonder if you could talk, so when does this first occur, and is it associated with the same political tactics and violence that we more generally know about that was directed against African Americans?
Well, I think the easy answer is yes, it is related. What's critical about all this is that eventually African Americans will receive some protection from the federal government. So in a way, the kind of paranoia, the suspicion, the hostility towards the federal government by white Southerners is justified. There is reason to fear the federal government getting involved in Southern race relations. Once that happens, though, with the Civil Rights Act of 64, with the Voting Rights Act of 65, then it becomes very difficult to race bait as openly as had been the custom in the past. You don't have George Wallace standing on steps and at the inaugural saying segregation now, segregation forever. But there is a kinship between targeting the other, whether the other in the South is blacks, which is the obvious number one, or it's Catholics, Jews, immigrants, those perceived to be of questionable patriotism, those who don't reflexively get behind every military action that the United States decides it wants to engage in, moral nonconformists, and others, so that there is that kinship, there is that theme, and what happens in the South is that a lot of those people, so-called undesirables, become identified eventually with the modern Democratic Party, which takes under its umbrella, you know, women who are feminists or people who believe in reproductive rights or gays, homosexuals, or people that believe gays should have rights, people that question wars, any manner of things. And so this becomes incredibly important for the history of the South, the politics of the South. And as the South becomes the bedrock of the National Republican Party, it becomes very important for the whole country.
Yeah, let's get to your central thesis or the crux of the book, which is this dubious nature of the Solid South and so the partisanship and which party is in power and when. So, and before we get to your argument, what's the conventional wisdom that you're out to overturn? You titled the book, The Irony of the Solid South. You're challenging an existing notion about how solid the South was and for how long, and that is how solidly democratic the South was. What is that conventional wisdom that you're trying to confront in building this case about this being ironic?
Well, I think that the conventional wisdom is that the South was almost completely solid from Reconstruction to the 1960s, and that there was tremendous democratic allegiance, which there was in many, many, many respects. I also think that the nature of the New Deal and Southern liberalism is challenged by the book, and the basic story is that, you know, the Southern liberalism was something very praiseworthy. Southern liberalism was almost flawless. And what I compare this to at one point, I believe, maybe in this book or somewhere else, is that when you're a person drowning in the ocean or somewhere, any piece of wood floating by that floats is wonderful. And so in the South, when you're surrounded by a sea of conservatism and beyond that, even reaction, and strong illiberalism, anything that floats by that is different, that in any way is the least bit moderately progressive, is grasped onto and held tightly here for life by Southern liberals, and later is almost above or beyond reproach. And so I wanted to look a little bit at the actual, you know, real nature of Southern liberalism, how effective it really was.
So if the conventional argument is that somewhere around 1964 or 1965, this great change happens, and your argument is that it's earlier, without putting on the spot and asking for a specific date when this happened, what's the year? What are the time period that you're arguing the power and dominance of the Democratic Party in much of the South goes away? And your, much of the focus of the book is on the state of Alabama, but it's, you know, you're writing about other states as well. So when are we looking? When in this time period do you see that the actual shift taking place?
Well, I think that there are two answers to that. One is 1933 to 1935, when Franklin Roosevelt comes to power. I think that is critical, especially after 1935. 1935 and after, when black people are actually, for the first time really, included in government programs, government policies. It's not overt, it's not in your face. Roosevelt is timid, Roosevelt is reluctant, he's prodded along by Eleanor Roosevelt, Harold Ickes, and many others. But 1935 is critical. And again, the next year, 1936, you have black people voting for the first time for the Democratic Party. Now, that's an historic change. That's a watershed, because prior to that, black people had been devoted to the party of Lincoln, or the Republican Party, for good reason. So 1935 is critical, and I look a lot at the 1930s. But beyond that, what's interesting, I think, is that these tendencies were always there, and I say always, at least from 1865 onward. The struggle in the South, you know, where you did have some independent and liberal, especially economically liberal, challengers to the Southern Bourbons or the Southern status quo, was resolved in favor of the Southern Bourbons, Southern conservatism, Southern reaction. And so what you see happening in the 30s does have echoes that go back to the 1860s, the 1870s as well. So it's kind of a two-part answer. The first part is fairly obvious, 1935.
And just before then, and you write about this in chapter 4, the election, or at least the campaign, of Al Smith, from New York. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about what that campaign means and what it illustrates about sort of the politics of the South during that time period, the opposition to Al Smith's candidacy.
Well, the 1928 election was incredibly important because the National Democratic Party, which had always been the bastion of, at least for white Southerners, it had been the bastion for conservatism, white supremacy, etc. The National Party nominated a New York Catholic, of immigrant background, who was associated with Tammany Hall. And this was a tremendous shock to the South and split the South, apart. It split Alabama apart. It split the South apart. A Republican, Herbert Hoover, wound up taking some Southern states and cracking the solid South. But more than that, it was a reflection of what was going on in the National Democratic Party. In 1924, in New York, at the National Convention, there were actually fist fights on the floor. There was pandemonium, practically a riot, when there was an anti-Klan plank introduced to be part of the national platform. And so what you have in the National Democratic Party is a struggle between a white, rural, Protestant, dry, as in anti-pro, as in pro-prohibition, wing versus an urban, immigrant, wet, northeastern, wing. And this is, it cannot be held together. This coalition cannot be held together. So 1928, it does crash. Alabama comes within a hair of going Republican. Largely thanks to the work of the Ku Klux Klan in Alabama. And there are many people who speculate that the state really did vote for Herbert Hoover, and there was simply shenanigans in the Black Belt, which was famous for electoral fraud that swung the state to the Democratic column. So the 28 election is massively important too, and that's why I kind of referenced, you know, although we can pinpoint 1935, we have to look back to what was going on further. But I think one of the major lessons that came out of 1928 is this, and that is white people in the South realized that if they could ever patch up their differences between the various classes of white people, between the elites and plain white people, if those differences could ever be patched up, then the partisan beneficiary of that would be impregnable and unassailable in the South. And that's basically what happens.
You write this about, you know, a long period of history. But you also, throughout the book, you bring this up to today. And you talk in the book a number of times about the Tea Party. So, in the interest of time, let me just sort of end here and ask you to talk a little bit about how you associate politics today in the South and the advent of the Tea Party and where it fits into this historical narrative that you write about the late 1800s and early 1900s. How does this current movement fit into? Is it a likely outgrowth of that time period that you study? Is it unlikely? What does it share in common? How do you make sense of the Tea Party?
Unfortunately, it's not a big surprise to me. I do think that the Tea Party is intellectually and ideologically connected to some of the more unfortunate manifestations of politics in the South. I realize that the Tea Party is a nationwide phenomenon, but I do believe that the Southern model is incredibly important for what has become the right wing of the Republican Party today and the right wing in general. And the Tea Party, in many unfortunate respects, bears a lot of resemblance to the Dixiecrats of 1948, to Klan movements beforehand, to what Richard Hofstadter called the paranoid style in American politics that's had a very, very long career. So the Tea Party really, I think, to George Wallace, you know, I think that the Tea Party has it didn't come out of nowhere. It's angry, it's resentful, it hates taxes, and I think right under the surface of it, there's a real emotional dislike for the takers, those who aren't producers, all the Ayn Randian rhetoric that comes out of libertarianism. And so, no, it's not really a surprise to me. It's a rather unfortunate, I think, outgrowth of the past.
Yeah. Yeah, as I mentioned at the start, I really enjoyed the book. I think it's a very interesting history, and I think the political science portions of this also are very interesting. What's up next for you? Do you have a new book project, an upcoming project that is tied to this, or a new book project or other related research that is different from this. What can we expect from you next?
Well, I guess the answer is both. This was really the first half of a two-part project, so I'm hoping to finish the second half and bring the story up to at least the middle of the 1950s. On the second hand, I'm working on the question of money, history, and capitalism, and capitalism in all its forms and the effect that that's had on history nationwide. So that will be more of a national project. And thirdly, I'm working on something related to national conservatism, or what happened to national conservatism after the 1950s to push it further and further in the direction of really what's, I think today, something that cannot really be called conservative anymore. It has to be called a radical or extremist movement.
Well, yeah, well, I look forward to what comes next, because I enjoyed your current book, The Irony of the Solid South, Democrats, Republicans, and Race, 1865 to 1944, published this year from University of Alabama Press, widely available. Glenn, I really thank you for the book, and I also thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Heath. My pleasure.